Tout d'abord, merci beaucoup, Lisa Antebife et Yemini, pour et aux organisatrices de cette rencontre, pour l'invitation à participer à ce colloque et l'occasion d'avoir un séjour dans cette magnifique ville, la Serenissima, Venezia. Merci beaucoup. Deuxième remarque, un coup de chapeau aux étudiants et aux étudiantes italiens, italiennes, qui suivent un colloque dans une langue qui n'est pas la leur. Et troisième remarque, une invitation à participer à une école doctorale qui aura lieu à Tübingen en juillet prochain, the second Tübingen Summer School, from July 25th, one week, sur le sujet Male and Female, He Created Them, the Biblical Words from Genesis 1 and the Interpretation of These Words in the Jewish, Christian and Muslim tradition. Malheureusement, I did not succeed in finding a possibility to copy, so I just give this round and you can have a look and make this call for papers and make your notes maybe. Alors, on m'a dit que je dois utiliser la langue anglaise. Je vais changer alors et parler anglais. I would like to give you three biblical texts. Maybe quite short, only three texts, not more. Okay, three biblical texts. The first one is Exodus 21, 7 to 11. The second one is Deuteronomy 24, 1 to 5. And the third one is Deuteronomy 21, 13 to 21. Three texts. And I want you to remember the time when you first read the Bible. Imagine the time when you read the Bible in school, in your childhood, in your first semester. Where do you think you found the first normative text on matrimonial law? Not a text that tells a story, but the text that says how the matrimonial norms should be. Imagine you read chapter after chapter, page after page, and the children of Israel are in Egypt, and they walk out, they wander in the desert, and you still have not found a normative text, legislation, on the matrimonium, on how marriage should be. And then they arrive on Mount Sinai, and of course, in Exodus chapter 20, the first thing you hear, you read, when you read the Bible, I mean, chronologically, in a bit naive way, like the Bible presents itself, they get the Decalogue. And then immediately in the next chapter after the Decalogue, which is a quite prominent place in the Bible, you find the first text at all, that says something normative about marriage. So it seems to be that this text is the first thing that the children of Israel ought to know about marriage, what marriage is about. And this is a very strange text. I shall read it to you. I chose the King James Version because in English it is as odd as the original in Hebrew is for today's Hebrew speaker. It's a very odd text. Exodus 21. And if a man sell his daughter to be a maidservant, she shall not go out as the men servants do, And if she please not her master, who hath betrothed her to himself, then shall he let her be redeemed. To sell her unto a strange nation he shall not have power, seeing he hath dealt deceitfully with her. And if he have betrothed her unto his son, he shall deal with her after the manner of daughters. If he take him another wife, her food, her raiment, and her duty of marriage shall he not diminish. Very strange situation. The first thing that the children of Israel have to know about marriage is the case that a father sells his daughter, and that the new owner of this slave, this girl, chooses to marry her, or chooses to give this daughter to his sons, that the son marries her, and then should this son take a second wife, we have many ifs, one if after the other, and then if this son takes a second wife, this son should not diminish three things. And now we have very strange Hebrew words, and nobody knows what they exactly mean. Tamar, I don't know whether you know. I don't know what it means. Yes. Food, her food, she'ara, ksut, ksuta, and onata. And if you check that in the dictionary, it is really unclear what it means. The historians are not sure what it means. The funny thing is that the Talmud makes it clear. The Talmud makes it clear, and here we have the first point for divorce. Let me say one thing. There is a tradition that says the fact that the Bible starts with such a really strange case on matrimonial law, the most strange of cases. Can a father imagine to sell his daughter? I mean, it's very, very strange. The fact implies that there must have been, from the beginning, an oral tradition. This does not work without oral tradition. Can you imagine the children of Israel standing on below Mount Sinai and hearing this on marriage? There must have been something accompanying it. It's impossible. It's impossible. You cannot think of it. Okay, now the Talmud. There's one treatise, treatise on matrimonial law, which is called the Ketubot, on marriage treatises. And this treatise has, in the Jewish tradition, a very interesting name. It is called Le Petit Chas, the Little Chas, the Little Talmud. Because this treatise is so important that it implies virtually everything. I think that is a little bit an exaggeration. It does not imply everything, but it is held in so high esteem that it's very important treatise, and you find many things that are discussed. They are very controversial in the Jewish traditional world in this treatise until today. So this treatise says something about verse number 10, Exodus 21, number 10. If the son takes him another wife, she'ara, ksuta, unata, her food, her raiment, and her duty of marriage, shall he not diminish. And in Hebrew and in English? In English, food, raiment, garment, clothing, and her duty of marriage. So the Talmud says, whatever that means, ona, what is ona? Ona means season. Ona could mean period, something that comes again all the time. The Talmud says, we don't know what it means, we don't know what the first word means, We don't know what the second word means. We don't know what the third word means. But we know that altogether, it should mean la nourriture, clothing, and it should mean sexual relations. The duty of marriage. Regardless what each particular word refers to. In the sum, Shura Tachtona, at the end, it means these three things. Well, it's quite interesting, a sort of hermeneutics. For the Talmud, the outcome is clear. It should mean these three things, regardless whether we succeed linguistically to decipher these things precisely in these words. Very interesting. So here we have the first thing that concerns divorce, because here in this verse, the mutual obligations of husband and wife are concerned, and the basic argument is an argument that we call in Hebrew kal vachomer. In the European tradition, we say de minore ad maius, meaning if already a slave girl has the right for la nourriture, for food, for clothing, and for sex, the slave girl has a right to sex, yes? Then all the more does have a normal wife, and of course the husband, yeah, has the right to this. So here we have a first element that enters into the discussion on what could be a reason for divorce. The second biblical text is as odd, as difficult. The first text on divorce has also many ifs. If a man has taken a wife and married her, and it came to pass that she find no favor in his eyes because he hath found some uncleanness, says the King James Version, in her, let him write her a bill of divorcement and give it in her hand and send her out of the house. And then again, certain ifs, and at the end, the sense of the whole phrase is that he cannot marry her again. Many ifs, very special case. So first of all, maybe you think that we should find here in this verse the Jewish term for divorce. Everybody will know what divorce in Hebrew means today, get. But get is not what you find in this text. This text says Sefer Kritut. It does not say get. So again, when we read the Talmud, we find the art of hermeneutics that reads something into the text which is not in the text, and tries to push something in or tear something out. The Talmud makes now something very interesting. When the man finds some uncleanness, says the King James Version. And the Hebrew text is very strange. It says, Ervat Davar. Ervat Davar is virtually untranslatable. Because it gives the impression as if there is a confusion between nominative and genitive. It should say a matter of uncleanness or a matter of indecency. But really, it says an indecency of a matter. It's the other way around. An indecency of a matter. So what does the husband find in this text? And now we have the discussion of the rabbis and the Talmud. They discuss it. What is it? And in order to understand the Talmudic discussion, it can sometimes be very interesting to read New Testament texts. Because in the New Testament, you can see historically some kind of Jewish discussion. Remember this famous scene in the New Testament, the Gospel of Matthew. The Pharisees come along and they ask Jesus, "Is it lawful for a man to put away his wife? Is it lawful to give a, is it permitted according to the law to divorce?" This question doesn't make sense because everybody would say, of course it is lawful because it's written in the Torah. You can do it, of course. So the question goes, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? For every, what are the reasons? What are the reasons? And as you all know, of course, Jesus says, no, it's not allowed. And according to one tradition, Jesus says it is only allowed for adultery. Yes, if something happened, adultery. And in the early rabbinic texts, we have the discussion between the two schools, one school of Hillel and the school of Shammai. And one school is more severe, and the other school is more lenient. So guess what does more lenient mean in this case? More lenient means that it gives more rights, of course, to the husbands, to the men. And more severe is to restrict the possibilities of divorce. The house of Shammai says a man should not divorce his wife except if he found indecency in her, since it says, for he found in her ervat davar. And however you translate it, it's a matter of indecency. The school of Hillel says, and it makes something special in rabbinic hermeneutics, they split this genitive construction apart, saying, as I said, you can't really translate matter of indecency, it is indecency of a matter. So indecency means indecency. Indecency means fornication, or means adultery, it means sexual, something bad, sexual thing. And matter means matter, just anything. So you can find another reason, because maybe the wife spoiled the dish, maybe the wife did something wrong, maybe the wife, and then Rabbi Akiva said, even if he found somebody more beautiful. Yeah, if he found a wife more beautiful, he has the right to divorce her. So that is the starting point for the rabbinic discussion. And what I want to show you now in the rest of the couple of minutes is how the rabbinic discussion goes on and makes this more difficult, because that was only the beginning. I mean, to dismiss a wife only because I found somebody who's more beautiful, that is not what is the habit in Judaism today. It's very far away, from that. The third biblical text is Deuteronomy 21, 13 to 21, the biblical law on virginity charges. Again, very, very Tanat Betulim, which means the charges that the husband, the bridegroom, passed the first night with the bride and found that something wrong. She was not Betula, she was not a virgin. Yes? Something, and what happens then? How to do it? How to prove it with the dra, with the cloth? Yes. What to do? And what fine to pay? And what happens if his charges were wrong? Yes. If the woman can prove that she was virgin and so on. And then now the rabbinical hermeneutics comes in, and I think that rabbinical hermeneutics is always something about the interaction between text and practice. Because Talmud is practice. Yes, it is practice. It has that has become text. The Talmud makes this more complicated. And I want to show you, I've prepared here pages for copying, but I didn't find a possibility to copy. So if somebody is interested in these Talmudic texts, I can give these to you if you want for copy. And I think that is what I will show you now is something as a... Some parts I think is new. I learned a lot by an Israeli scholar Tal Ilan of the Hebrew University who has worked on that, and I think I can enlarge a little bit on it because I can show that there are more texts. The Talmud says that basically the Tanat Betulim, basically the virginity charges, are to use the French expression caduque. It makes no sense. It is virtually impossible to go into virginity charges and to prove them. It's virtually impossible. And there is a process of this interpretation that goes on from the earlier rabbinical texts to the later rabbinical texts, starting with the Talmud of Jerusalem and ending in the Talmud of Babylon. I will give you the text again in the treatise on Ketubot. First of all, the text says that the Mishnah, the Talmudic law says that the wedding day has to be Wednesday. You must, if you marry a virgin, an obligation to marry on Wednesday, Yom Revi'i, the fourth day of the week. Why? Because on the fifth day, the courts come together, and the husband should have a possibility that in the case he found something that was wrong with his wife, he could the next day stand up in the morning and go directly to court. Yes? That's how the entire treaty starts. So that's also very weird, very weird. Yes, to start the wedding, maybe the most important day of your entire life, to study that with the idea, maybe I will find out that my bride is no virgin, and then the next day I go to court. And then the entire treatise is demolishing this idea. Because this is impossible. And the Talmud shows in several stages, so I will make that short. First of all, they say, Rabbi Yonah, in the name of Rabbi Crispus, an adult woman is like an open amphora, petach patuach, which is terribly misogyn. It's terrible, you could say, yes? It means that it is not according to common sense, or you should not presuppose that an adult woman has not had sexual relations. If a woman is adult, she has had sexual relations. So it is not according to common sense that if you marry an adult person that she is a virgin. The first argument. The second argument is about anatomy, biologics. Very strange also. They say there are possibilities that the hymen could grow again after it was destroyed. And if you start, if you put in this idea in the discussion, I mean, then you can prove everything. I would like to read to you some text that takes this further from the in the Babylonian Talmud, in Ketubot 10a and 10b. Someone came before Rabban Gamliel and said to him, "I have found an open opening, Petach Patuach." Meaning, the husband comes the next morning, said it was all already open, and there is a deceit, yeah? Virginity charge. Rabban Gamliel answered, "Perhaps you moved aside." Second case, someone came before Rabban Gamliel, the son of Rabbi, and so said, "My master, I have had intercourse with my newly wedded wife, and I have not found any blood. She, the wife, said to him, "My master, Rabbi, I was a virgin." He said to them, "Bring me that cloth." They brought him the cloth, and he soaked it in water, and he washed it, and he found on it a good many drops of blood. So it is reduced to a washing, to a technical procedure, how to deal with the cloth. Yeah? It's reduced to that. Third story. Someone came before Rabban Gamliel, the elder, and said to him, my master, I had intercourse with my newly wedded wife, and I found no blood. She, the wife, said to him, "My master, I am of the family of Dorkati." This is very strange. Dorkati is a Greek word that has entered into the Talmudic text here. Turgete means dry. In Greek, so there are several possibilities to translate it. I have here the Sonchino translation of the Talmud. I think that this translation is not quite correct. They think that Dorkati must mean a family where, for would say genetic reasons or hereditary reasons in the family, there is no blood. Yeah, that's the kind of family. They don't have it. I think it should be translated, meaning that first of all, it is remarkable that what they use here is a Greek word, because always when you introduce a foreign word, it makes things more mysterious. Something is here. Yes. And this girl is dry. It has no blood for biological reasons whatsoever. So there is no reason to go on with the virginity charges. It makes no sense. Virginity charges are caduc. I will end in a few minutes. The fourth example. Someone came before Rabbi Nachman and said to him, "I have found an open opening, Petach Patuach." Rabbi Nachman answered, "Lash him with palm switches." Lash him. The husband has to be punished. The husband. Lash. Lash. Hit him. Beat him. Beat him. Why? Because it is the question is asked, how does he know? Assuming that this has been his first wedding, one has to assume that he gained his knowledge from the experience with prostitutes. How could he know how this thing works? So the Talmud is full of examples, and I think the further you go on in time, the more virginity charges are very forcefully discouraged. And I would say the climax is that in some Talmudic texts, they even say that the possibility is there that a woman could get pregnant without having had intercourse. A woman could become pregnant when bathing and being in water where a man before had put his semen in it, and it could be absorbed in her body. However, even the fact that a woman is pregnant does not prove that she has committed adultery. And the fact is that in the entire Talmud you find no example of a virginity charge that has been successfully pursued and has ended in favor of the charge of the husband. I would think that this is, to my mind, a good example of the way these questions are discussed in the Talmud. And with this, I end. And thank you very much for your patience.